WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Christian Coalition is promoting its Contract with the American Family, a social and cultural counterpart to the Republican Contract with America. The coalition says the contract is intended to strengthen families and restore values. The 10-point proposal includes calls for increasing restrictions on abortion, easing restrictions on prayer in schools and religious displays in public places, eliminating the Department of Education, returning education control to the local level, providing tax relief for families, and restricting pornography on the internet and cable TV. My guest, Keith Fournier, is the head of the ACLJ, the American Center for Law and Justice, founded by Pat Robertson, who also founded the Christian Coalition. Fournier consulted on the drafting of the contract. He says the courts have been too strict in interpreting the Establishment Clause, the part of the First Amendment which states, "Government shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion." And that's why the contract is proposing a new constitutional amendment to protect religious liberties in public places.
Well, I think one of the things that people need to understand about the Religious Equality Amendment is it's been necessitated by what we at the ACLJ believe has been very bad jurisprudence or legal court decisions surrounding the so-called Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution, which is in the First Amendment. We've had some decisions that have ended up creating a hostile environment toward religious faith and toward religious expression. And we think this amendment works much like a clarifying amendment to undo that hostility and to once again reassert the First Amendment for what it's supposed to be, which is an amendment that protects speech, no matter what the content of the speech.
So what would you like people to be able to do that they cannot do now?
Well, Terry, for example, in spite of the First Amendment's protections and even the Equal Access Act, which was the act that protected religious clubs on a high school campus if any extracurricular clubs are allowed to meet, despite that, we still face almost daily problems where high school students are being precluded from having religious clubs. Or in one case we're involved in now out of New York, if they have such a club, whether it be a Bible club or a rosary club or any kind of religious or club, they can't select the leaders of the club. Now, this is wrong, and it is, we believe, a direct result of some bad Establishment Clause cases and even their misapplication and misinterpretation. Or similarly, those who oppose our position often say, including Ira Glasser now, my contemporary in the ACLU, that students have a right to gather around a flagpole and pray. Well, I'm glad he's changed his position on that, but I wish that we didn't have to litigate that issue all across the country.
What about the issue of school prayer?
Well, that's what I'm talking about, voluntary student-led, student-initiated prayer. That's what the amendment stands for. We are not in favor of state-proscribed prayer, having the teacher pray or the principal pray. We are not in favor, in spite of what adversaries often say, of a theocracy. But Terry, if I thought this whole movement was about a theocracy, I'd have a problem with it. I'm a Roman Catholic. I certainly am not interested in any established religion in this country. What we want is the free exercise of religion, and we want the freedom of expression given to religious people and religious principle, whether it be in high school, in the marketplace. We think the pendulum has swung too far, and that this kind of amendment is necessary to undo the damage of almost 30 years of poor legal precedent, and also, in particular, the application of what's called the Lemon Test out of Lemon versus Kurtzman. It is our opinion that the Establishment Clause was never intended to keep religion and religious influence out of the public square. It was intended to prevent the government from coercing all of us to a certain tenet of beliefs.
Getting back to school prayer, should there be prayers over school intercoms? Should there be time set aside in school for silent or out loud prayer?
See, those are all details that are going to have to be worked out on the state level. I think there are problems with the use of the intercom, because if it is seen as somehow being sponsored by the state, they maybe could be overcome through allowing a student use of the intercom. But these are things that local school boards should deal with. What we want to see happen is that this notion that any kind of religious expression or prayer, whether it's gathering around a flagpole, a moment of silence, a moment of reflection, is somehow now seen as out of the pale.
You say some details would have to be worked out later, for instance, details worked out by local school boards, and that might open up the way for prayer on school intercoms. Isn't that exactly what frightens some people the most about your religious equality amendment,
is
that it would be opening up the door for prayer over school intercoms?
No, I think that's the most problematic. What I tried to say was if there is some student use of the intercom system allowed in the school, then some religious sentiment expressed in the context of that might be allowable. But I would not recommend that. In fact, I think it becomes really problematic because the intercom is actually school property, and at least within the public school system right now, using it to advance the prayer probably would not cut the mustard. So rather than a parade of horribles of the worst-case scenario in some people's mind, what this amendment, in our opinion, does is simply clarify and otherwise confused landscape, and once again allow voluntary, student-led, student-initiated prayer and religious expression to flourish. Because that, by the way, is what it was intended to do in the first place. Religion was never intended, or religious principle, to be squeezed out of the public square and kept behind the doors of a church.
I want to move on to another item in the contract with the American family, and this is called Restoring Respect for Human Life. It includes protecting the rights of states that do not fund abortion, protecting
sure.
innocent human life by placing real limits on late-term abortions, and ending funds to organizations that promote and perform abortions. Now, this contract is not calling for the outlaw of abortions.
In this particular platform, it is not, I think, and again, I don't speak for the coalition, I speak for the ACLJ. I don't think there's any question about the Christian Coalition's moral position as it relates to abortion, that it is the taking of innocent, unborn human life. But it's a political organization that is seeking to recognize what ground can be gained to protect a whole class of people. And so it has put forth in this platform those limitations that most reasonable people right now support.
One of the items in the contract with the American family calls for protecting parental rights. It says the Constitution doesn't explicitly set forth protections of parental rights. The rights of parents, however, are under increasing assault in modern-day society. Which parental rights are under assault?
We believe that we need to once again reinstitute in both jurisprudence and legislation the primacy of the family, the two-parent, marriage-bound, intact family, as the primary mediating institution. You know, in sociology, we use the term mediating institutions. There's the family is the first one. It's the first school. It's the first government. It's the first church. And it ought to have primacy in legislation and in policy. And we think that there has been a trend to move away from seeing parents as the first teachers of their children, making the decisions about their education, and instead to insert a notion of the government as parent. Now, it would take a long time to explain that, but I think it's very clearly happening. And this platform and those who support this kind of move toward restoring respect for the family is one step in an effort to once again see the family reemerge as the primary mediating institution and allow parents to make the decisions about the training of their children, the education of their children, and to recognize that the first government in this country and in any civilization is the one in the home. And in fact, all other governments flow out of and should support that government.
Protecting parental rights, as described in the contract, is tied in with returning educational control to the local level. There's a lot of concern that school vouchers and tax credits for private schools and religious schools will hurt the public school system. What's your reaction to that?
Oh, I think the opposite is true. It will help the public school system for three reasons. One, it'll make it once again truly public, which means that the public is determining what's taught in the schools, the public is determining whether or not teachers are effective in doing their job, and competition in the public school system would be the greatest thing that could happen. I know one of my sons asked me, well, gee, Dad, if public school choice is passed in Virginia, what if parents don't like this particular high school? And it ends up having to go out of business. And my answer was quite simply, as a parent, well, maybe it needs to go out of business anyway or be taken over by the other high school that they do like. That kind of competition in the public system, rather than ending it, I think would make it more effective, because competition in the marketplace does the same thing, and returning control to the parents is what that's all about. I do not think we'll see the end of public schools in this country. I think what we'll see once again is the reemergence of truly public schools by re-empowering parents to make the decisions about which ones are working and which ones are not. And by the way, I don't think anyone in the public school system needs to fear the voucher system, which allows parents to choose private education as well, because all it does is puts poor families or middle-income families in the same situation that wealthy families have right now. Wealthy families have the choice. President Clinton, for example, can send his daughter, and rightly so, to a religious academy. All vouchers would do, if school choice involved not only public but private schools, is allow the person who works at the steel mill the same right. So I think we're in the midst, Terry, of a revolution in the educational environment, and the status quo or the establishment doesn't like it, but the American family knows it's necessary and supports it.
If the proposals for education in the contract were converted into legislation, do you think that it would have a bad impact on public schools, that more people who could afford it would go to private schools and only the very poor would be left in public schools, and the poor would not have an alternative? The poor would, you know, the voucher wouldn't be sufficient for a poor parent to send their child to a private school.
Terry, I actually believe that good legislation, whether it be vouchers, credits, or whatever, in this whole arena of reopening education again, and once again asserting choice and giving parents the choice, it would have the opposite impact. It would empower the poor parents to be in the same position as wealthy parents are right now. And I'm convinced that a voucher or a credit system which opens it up and empowers the parents to make the decisions would make for a better public school system.
The contract talks about the primacy of parents. I wonder if that relates at all to the contract with America that the House passed. And in the welfare part of that contract, it says that a single mother under the age of 18 would not be entitled to welfare benefits. Doesn't that put the state in the position of deciding who an appropriate parent is? Does that put the state in the position of interfering with the primacy of parents?
Terry, that's a very, very interesting question. And I have to tell you that, first of all, I'm not here to defend every action taken in the first 100 days by the 104th Congress, because I'm not so sure that I personally agree with every action. Rather, I'm here to talk about the current document called the Contract with the American Family, put forth by the Christian Coalition, which I do personally agree with. However, in trying to respond to your question, I think a bigger issue is emerging in the first 100 days and now in this 100 days, and that's the role of government and who ought to be helping the single mother and what are the right mediating institutions to be dealing with the needy single mother or the orphan or those who are poor or impoverished. And philosophically, I think this whole issue is being discussed again, and it needs to be, because I think the primary mediating institutions to deal with caring for the needy and the poor and the orphans and the single parents are the church, voluntary associations, philanthropic organizations, and government would be better served both on the federal level and the state level by once again empowering those organizations to do their job. Nobody wants to see that single mother out on the street. I certainly don't. And it is not the Christian position to want to see that single mother out on the street. I think what we need to look at again, however, is the whole social compact. What should the government be doing, whether federal or state, and what kind of partnerships can be made to enable other associations, whether they be churches, synagogues, mosques, philanthropic groups, voluntary associations, to continue caring for the needy and the poor.
What do you think is the most important item in the contract with the American family?
My personal opinion?
Yeah.
My personal opinion is that the most important item in the contract with the American family is the provision that is trying to restore respect for human life. Because ultimately, I am convinced as a father, as a husband, as a citizen, as a Roman Catholic, I'm convinced that the current state of abortion in this country is horrific, and it is the cutting edge of a culture of death, and that how we treat innocent, unborn life, and the elderly, and the infirmed, is going to determine our very future. So I think that the fundamental issue is life, and I would have to say that restoring respect for life is the most important platform in this contract.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, I want to thank you for allowing me to talk with you, and I wish you the best.
Keith Fournier is the head of the ACLJ, the American Center for Law and Justice, founded by Pat Robertson. Coming up, Jim Wallace, co-founder of a new coalition of religious leaders that is countering the Christian Coalition. First a break. This is Fresh Air. A new coalition of religious leaders has formed as an alternative to the Christian Coalition. This new coalition has issued a statement called the Cry for Renewal. The endorsers include the heads of several denominations, Episcopal, Baptist, Quaker, Methodist, and African Methodist Episcopal, as well as the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. Several members of the coalition are evangelicals, including my guest, Reverend Jim Wallace. Wallace is also the co-founder of Sojourners, an evangelical religious community that lives in the inner city of Washington, D.C., and publishes a magazine about faith, politics, and culture. The coalition held its first press conference on Tuesday and announced its mission.
Finally, there is an alternative voice to the religious right. It was clear now to the press and to the political leaders up here in Washington that they don't speak for all people of faith. And they've already been pressed since our day of events to be more careful about who they say they represent. For example, last week, Ralph Reed said, "We want to be a permanent fixture on the political landscape for people of faith," he said. He defined that as those who have a devout faith, those who believe in values and civility in the public discourse, and those who go to church or synagogue. Now, that's a very big group of people. That includes me and most people I know. And we were saying, no, they deserve the right to be heard, but they don't speak for all of us. And we were black Christians and white Christians and evangelical Christians and Catholics and mainline Protestants. We were a real Christian coalition this week, and we said they don't speak for us.
One of the components of the contract is about abortion. Now, I know that you oppose abortion, too. Is this something you could get together with the drafters of the contract with the American family about?
Well, you see, President Clinton has said abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And it's legal. It's not always safe. But it certainly isn't rare. 1.5 million abortions a year is not rare. I think we have an opportunity here for some common ground between people on the pro-choice side and the pro-life side to try to act together to make abortions more rare. I think there's a common ground here to try to reduce the number of abortions. I don't believe criminalizing abortion is going to do that. The Speaker of the House, the Republican Speaker, has said himself a couple of weeks back that that would just make millions of women go to the back alleys for abortion. That's not the answer here. I think the real issue is creating a cultural climate that values women and values children, and out of that can make abortion more rare.
Now, I know you've met with Newt Gingrich, with House Majority Leader Dick Armey, and other members of Congress. What were the meetings like? Or was it just one meeting?
No, we met with the Democratic leadership and then the Republican leadership as well. And they were good meetings. They were very substantial. I was pleased. Both sides welcomed our voice, as they put it, into the mix. They said it's good to have other voices than just the religious right and the Christian coalition. And what we pressed both political parties on was the need for a new approach, that the old answers, liberal and conservative, aren't working at all, that we need something very, very new. And like in the contract, again, it talks about encouraging support for private charities. And I think that's a great thing. But it goes on to say, as a first step toward transforming the bureaucratic welfare state into a system of private and faith-based compassion. Well, we have to unpack what that means. We are those who pressed Mr. Gingrich and Gephardt on the fact that the old big bureaucracies, hierarchical systems are not transforming poverty. I live in a very poor neighborhood. It's not working. But abandoning the poor and dismantling the safety net without another alternative in place is not a moral option. So we press for this whole idea of new partnerships, public and private, in the civil society, neighborhood, school, churches, synagogues, in relationship with mayors and city councils, the business community, and government on all levels, to say we together have to solve these problems. The government can't do it by itself, but neither can churches and private charities alone shoulder the whole burden of what is now the welfare system. And so we press them to go beyond their ideological debate of entitlements versus block grants, neither of which answers the question of what kind of new strategies at the local level will work and where do we find the resources necessary to carry those out. That's a new conversation, and we got, and both sides said we want more dialogue about this. The speaker said I want 2 hours next month for a substantial dialogue, and the Democrats called and said we want the same thing. So hopefully we can have a different conversation than we've had before on these matters.
Is there a major point that you agree and a major point that you disagree with within the contract?
Well, I think, for example, we need new educational solutions at the local level. That's clear. But there are Christians who also don't want to see the public school system destroyed. So we need new configurations, maybe a variety of options, and that ought to be a good discussion. We believe that parents should have the right to nurture and raise and discipline their kids, but we also think kids in abusive families have to be protected. You know, on the pornography question, I'm pretty much in favor of restricting or protecting children from pornography and taking a much tougher line on child pornography especially. There are things in there that resonate with those of us who care about families, care about rebuilding families, about personal responsibility and moral values. But we also want to talk about how jobs and racism and sexism are also family issues. And we want to make sure that all our families are protected and not just some of them.
Jim Wallace, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Good to talk to you again.
Jim Wallace is a co-founder of a new ecumenical coalition that released a statement called The Cry for Renewal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.